Welcome back to the Preacher Podcast. It is All Saints Day, or shortly before All Saints Day, and we are thinking about our status in God's sight as His saints and what our lives look like in this world and anticipating the life to come as well. I'm John Mitchell from Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary. With me, Pastor John Bergman from Downers Grove, Illinois, Pastor Ben Tomczak from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Professor Alan Sorum from the seminary. Ben, could we start with you? Could you tell us a little bit about All Saints Day generally and a little bit about how this year's observance fits into the worship series that we're in?
Yeah, sure. All Saints is kind of a shift from the old new hymnal where we celebrate saints triumphant. And I think the emphasis on those lessons was often on the victory of those who had gone on before us into the heavenly kingdom. But on All Saints Day, we're going to look at the saints on earth as well as the saints on heaven, literally all the saints. And that'll be emphasized, especially in our lessons in Luke and Hebrews, and then we'll glance into heaven in Revelation. This week in our cause and effect, we're talking about how the status of sainthood is the cause for an effect of stamina, which when we think about status, I don't know if we'd like to think about that. We think of things like the status of being a billionaire, and you've got a lot of money, so you can buy whatever you want, and people are going to listen to you because you're a successful titan of industry, or the status of celebrity or influence, or your voice means something, so you'll get to be on TV. And if you get the status of a political office like senator or president, there's a lot that comes with it that goes with you your whole life. And I mean, presidents get the gold McDonald's card, for goodness sakes, or the status of being a Division I athlete where you get swagged up. You get all the gear you could possibly ever imagine. And then on top of it, people with those statuses who don't need stuff get more stuff from people. They're already millionaires or famous, and they keep getting handed free things. And now we're going to talk about our status that through Christ, because of Christ, God says not just a few select people, not just ones voted on by cardinals or popes, not just those who have died, but all Christians are saints. And you know what we get? A tough life, a difficult struggle. As we read the end of Hebrews today and we listen to Luke in the gospel, it seems like instead of our life being easier, it's more of a struggle than it could ever imagine. We see the future being a saint and it's getting sawed into two. So thankfully, God doesn't end the conversation with saying, well, good luck. He talks about the things that will now build the stamina. It starts with that status of sainthood, that by becoming a saint, we have the promise of eternal life in the kingdom where there'll be no more mourning, crying, or pain. We get to see the future, which is the one thing that'll get us through the present, in which we may not be handed that golden McDonald's card. So we have to rely on promises from God.
Thank you. John, could you remind preachers of the other readings for the day before we get into the second reading for our sermon text discussion?
Yes. John was a saint by faith in Jesus Christ, Saint John. But as he's living in exile on Patmos, it doesn't look like he's very triumphant. He's going through difficult persecution, difficulty, pain. And in Revelation 21, 1 through 6, we see how he's allowed to see the future home of where he will be residing, as well as all the saints, the New Jerusalem, heaven, a place where there will be no more persecution, death, mourning, crying, or pain. The old order of things has passed away. That's the home that we're going to live in forever as well. And then in Luke chapter 6, 20 through 23, the gospel, Jesus teaches that truth to his disciples that the blessedness of being a saint of God is currently hidden from our sight in so many ways. And so Jesus says, even really, if you are poor, hungry, when people hate you and insult you and all this, you are blessed because you are a saint of God. And then, of course, one day you will rejoice in that great reward in heaven, the place and home where you will live forever with all saints of all time.
Thank you. Let's turn then to the second reading, recommended as the sermon text in our worship series. Alan, could you get our discussion started regarding Hebrews 11, 32 through 40?
Absolutely. The thing that would be a good starting point, I think, is just a review from like 10,000 feet of what Hebrews is all about. This is a pastor writing a sermon to his people that he has reason to believe are slipping away from the solid ring of Jesus Christ. And so he writes this pastoral letter to make the case that Jesus is a much better place to secure your future hope and faith and security than anything else. And he states as the goal, let's make sure we all see Jesus. Where we are in the outline right now is in the final portion of Hebrews, he is now making his strong case of encouragement for his people to hang in there and to be faithful. He's up to this point, he's made the case why they should be faithful, and now he's really, really encouraging them to be faithful. And we have here in chapter 11 a group of people who have been faithful, even though they never got to see Jesus Christ. They weren't there yet for his coming to earth, taking on human flesh, and achieving our salvation through the cross. Our text begins at verse 32. Up to this point, he's been describing Old Testament heroes and giving us a little background about them. But now he just lists their names without any background. And it seems that now he's assuming the readers know their Bible history. It also seems that he's perhaps building to a crescendo. Of course, we're looking at a written text, but that is not how the Hebrew Christians received the text. This letter was read to them very much like a sermon. And so, as they received it through their ears, they could probably pick on the fact that the author's writing for the ear. He's picking up energy, he's making his case. So, he starts off with saying he doesn't have time to talk about these famous heroes, but the conversation of these heroes, I think he gives a good indication is how he brackets his closing argument in chapter 11. If you look at verse 33, he says, "Hoi dia pistos," that through faith they conquered kingdoms. But if you look down at verse 39, he has through the faith, through this faith that I've been talking about, this previously mentioned faith, they've attained the promises. So that perhaps that bracketing suggests a theme for this, that through the faith. Now, he says right away in verse 33 that through the faith they did all these things, including obtained promises. And one wonders if you go back to verse 13, chapter 11, verse 13, he said they didn't receive the promise. And then in verse 39, he says that through faith they did not obtain the promise. I don't want to make too much about the use of an article or not, but in verse 13 and in verse 39, he uses the article and he talks about perhaps a very specific promise he has in mind, namely the appearance of Jesus Christ, the mission of salvation he accomplished. Whereas in verse 33, there's no article. It's just a general, having received promises in a general kind of way, perhaps, that it, through their faithfulness, they would be blessed. But it's obviously not a contradiction. So continuing on these verses from like 33 on, you have all of these heroes of faith. These heroes of faith did amazing things through faith. Through faith, they endured amazing struggles and shame. Kind of thematically, here we see there's a shame being discussed that Christ went through. Think of the last chapter where Christ endured the shame of being sacrificed outside the camp. He endured that shame, and the author invites his people, invites us to go outside the camp with Jesus and endure that shame. Here we have a long list of Old Testament heroes that endured shame. And it's the same, perhaps, kind of shame that his people are going through right now. He's preparing them for the shame of a coming persecution, and he's establishing an incredible solidarity. Call it call it what you will, but it's the solidarity of suffering, shame, just as Jesus did it, our forerunner, in whose, as Peter says, in whose footsteps we walk. And these Old Testament believers, all of the Old Testament heroes, they endured this shame. And the irony is they saw Jesus. Think of chapter 2, what is it, chapter 2, verse 9, where, the author says, okay, we all want to see Jesus, but these Old Testament believers, they didn't see Jesus in the sense of knowing of his incarnation as a Hebrew boy born of the Virgin Mary, and yet they saw him through the eyes of faith and endured these sufferings and accomplished these great things. So why? Verse 35. There's that word that the author likes so much, so that they could achieve a Chrytinus Anastasos, a better resurrection. The ultimate goal for all of us, and he'll reference this in verse 40 when he talks about getting to the goal, is this better resurrection. And the Old Testament believers hung in there that they might receive this better resurrection. Now, he says the in verse 36 that they were mocked. And they received all of these difficult situations. And look at verse 38. They received all these difficult things from the world, verse 38, and the world was not worthy of them. Talk about turning things on its head. Talk about upending anything logical. Anything that you could possibly recognize as something you've experienced ever before. The world dished out all this shame upon these Old Testament heroes. The world was dishing out shame on this flock of Hebrew Christians, and this world was not worthy of those who were receiving this shame. Just an incredible different, a recasting of reality. How about that? A recasting of reality. So the world shamed them. And then look at verse 39. These, all of these who receive shame from the world, they received a testimony, and obviously a testimony from God, that through their faith, they would be blessed with receiving the promise. And there's that article. He's got a very specific promise, and that is being part of this universal church. It's been introduced. It's the theme of this Sunday. There is only one holy Christian church. God knows who it is. God foreordained who would be part of it by his grace through election. God keeps this holy Christian church safe through the continuing work of the Holy Spirit. And he gives this witness regarding these Old Testament heroes that they receive this faith. And the final verse, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us, that they would telaiothosin. Now, telaiothosin is very, very interesting in Hebrews. To be perfected, I think that's a really hard to understand translation. But the root, of course, in teleiothesis is telos, that all together, the better thing that God had in mind was that we'd all accomplish the goal together. We'd accomplish the goal. The Old Testament believers before us, the New Testament believers among us, the future Christians yet to be born into the world, that when Christ hung on the cross and endured hell and punishment for every single person on the planet, and then through the Holy Spirit's work, through the gospel, we come to faith in that work together, all together, this holy Christian church together is, accomplishes our goal. Our very purpose for being is to come to know Jesus, to remain in him, to be faithful to him, no matter what persecutions that he chooses for us to suffer for him. Because of him, to give a witness about him, that together as the holy Christian on earth, we enjoy this goal of being with God and seeing Jesus when he comes on the last day and not be afraid, but when we see him, we rejoice.
Thank you, Alan, for that run through of the text and highlighting many important and extremely comforting verses in this short text. Let's talk about preaching it a little bit. Thoughts on how to go about a text like this, either overarching thoughts, what you're going to encourage listeners with, or a main thought, or we can talk about law and gospel in the text as well. I'll just kind of open it up to Ben and John. Thoughts on the text as a whole, or getting into law and gospel themes in it?
Maybe just to echo what Alan said about the turn in this text, and I appreciate what he said of how this text reads like a sermon. It really does. And I think it's just so neat in verse 38. He highlighted that. That's like the mic drop moment. The world was not worthy of them. You know, a lot of times the world would accuse us of not being worthy of it. We're just these pesky Christians who bring this worldview that they don't want to deal with, but it's just the other way around. But that line stands out. But building up to that line is so neat too. When he gets into some of these first examples of these saints, it sounds pretty good. It's like, yeah, we're on the right team. These are people who conquered kingdoms, administered justice, gained what was promised, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, received their dead back. And then all of a sudden, middle of verse 35, that's where it really starts to turn out of nowhere. Others were tortured and refused to be released. And then they faced jeers and flogging, sawed in half. And you kind of go, I just imagine the audience going, wait, what? What? Can we rewind that a little bit?
Right.
This is still a good thing. And I think there's some great preaching fodder in that for our people too, as we perhaps would talk through a few of those stories. Sound good? Sound good? You can almost imagine people nodding and go, sawed in half. Sound good? Silence. Silence. So it's just such a neat text of how we said it turns on things like that. But then turns again, of course, at the end. We are triumphant.
Thank you. Ben, some thoughts on the text overall or th thinking about law and gospel?
Yeah, just continuing with all these things we've been talking about already. Thank you guys for really highlighting the word better and then getting to the end of it. We're going to come back to that. But I like the reminder that Alan gave us of this is a sermon. I've always thought of Hebrews that way too. Like I always, when I write a sermon, I think, well, why doesn't mine sound like this? And you talked about the crescendo. Imagine the beats that he must have been hitting and the crowd kind of getting into it. And I think, in November, we're thinking always of politics, right? We're always voting about something or getting ready to vote on something. And it seems like at this moment in our history, for at least for a few years, we've been working with a politics of fear. And we always got to be driving people to be scared of something or reclaiming some greatness that we've lost. Not new to us or our time, but that seems to be the dominating thing. And I can see kind of a two-sided danger, a mende danger that we can point out to our people as we think of the work of the church. On the one hand, as John pointed out, when the author gets to the kind of the bad things, the getting sawed in two bit and destitute and poor, as he's matching up with the gospel a little bit more, what Jesus says in Luke, I think it's easy for us to live in a time of never-ending gloom and doom. The church is getting the shaft. We're getting it's just death and destruction. It's all for sure and for certain. There are people getting sawed in two. Our pets' heads are falling off, for goodness sakes. It's weeping, it's hatred, it's exclusion. And what do we do with that? We can make ourselves victims. We can almost emasculate ourselves and have to be playing the martyr card in the worst possible way. And then we're tempted to use that as an excuse to hitch our wagon to some other power. Is it political power? Is it the Republicans or the Democrats? Is it military power? Is it turning to church growth techniques? Are we going to trade Jesus in for some mess of pottage because things are so bad? I'm so terrified, and the only way to make things better is thus and so. And I refuse to be like the saints who were tortured and refused release. On the other hand, because this preacher is doing so well, Barak and Gideon and da da da, I think we also have to be weary the da. We had the men. This is the debt of going the other way into kind of a sappy Joel Osteen Christian triumphalism. Victory, victory, victory. We're winning, we're winning, we're winning. Believe it and achieve it. I was minded of of his Lutheran Satires video on Lutheran or martyrs reading Joel Osteen's tweets. You got to watch it. It's worth 2.5 minutes of your time, where he has, for example, Peter being crucified upside down, saying, "Be bold and take control of your own life," or Stephen being stoned, John being beheaded, saying, "Don't speak defeat," or Abel getting murdered and saying, "You're too blessed to be stressed." We can fall into that Pollyanna view of the world and forget, yeah, people are going to get sawed into two. Jesus has said, "In this world you will have trouble, but I have overcome it." So I think that whole, and he gets that with a lot of people didn't get what was promised. Abraham didn't get to own the land. Moses didn't get to see the land. David never saw an unending kingdom. Solomon ended up with his life summarizing everything he'd ever done with the word meaningless. So we have to be wary both of just becoming a perpetual victim, giving into fear, or a triumphalist who's triumphing in all the wrong things.
I think so. And I think that might be a good angle for preachers to consider for part of the malady, at least. Latching on to the perks, so to speak, viewed from a worldly perspective of being a saint, but turning away from the other parts of it, the suffering. And John, I appreciate how, you pointed out kind of that turning point in the middle of verse 35. I think that is a dramatic way to present that. Further thoughts on kind of the law preaching from this text?
I think Ben gave some great examples there. A lot of that victimization thing. I certainly whine more than I ever want to or need to. Usually reading a bit of Jeremiah helps break me out of that, but when I read some of what these people went through, then I go, oh man, it convicts me there too. But as I go through these things, then personally too, I begin to doubt. Maybe this is part of the victim thing, but I doubt whether God is actually near. Is he actually in control? Whether I actually am on the winning team? Is it all for naught? And then as I look even deeper at myself, even if I'm not being persecuted this day or tomorrow, I don't feel triumphant because of my own sin, my own doubt, my own weakness, my own fear. The law is quite prevalent here. Even though this is an encouraging text, I think there's a lot of avenues into it we can find.
Well, you're saying, John, what Alan pointed out with the bookends of the faith reference, right? We have zero interest in living through faith or by faith, what this whole chapter is talking about. And if we're going to be honest, is there any reason God is going to commend us for our faith? I don't think we can. Who's going to raise their hand on that one? I'm going to be commended, not me.
Alan?
Yeah, just to pick up on that, Ben, we could certainly get law from where the author to the Hebrew Christians presents law. And he says at one point, I think chapter 5, he says, oh, you guys should be farther along than this. I really would like to talk about important things like how Jesus was a priest after the order of Melchizedek, but your children, and I think that would be something to talk about. I am going to give you now a workshop on enduring suffering and persecution at the hands of the world. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? What do you mean you're not ready for this? So that would be one idea. Another place where the preaching of the law in Hebrews is so strong. Kleinig for CPH wrote a commentary on Hebrews, and there's some good things about it. I didn't like everything about it, but one thing, an interesting comment he made is you don't find the strongest preaching of the law, the warnings in like in chapter 10 and chapter 6. You don't find the strong, those really strong warnings and pericopes, because whoever develops these pericopes are not sure that the preacher can handle this idea of despising the Holy Spirit and grace of God to the point where there's no sacrifice for sins that remains. And that's an interesting comment, and we should consider that. But what are we preferring to Jesus, and how are we, does that preference for a worldly thing, whatever that might be, actually equal despising the Holy Spirit and the grace that he wants to give us. Those are some pretty strong preachings of the law. And it comes at a time in our culture where there is so much pressure through social media and the cultural core values of our world, where it is intimidating. And maybe in order to fit in, to continue to be able to buy stuff on Amazon.com, we might prefer some things and actually end up despising Jesus. Pretty aggressive preaching of the law, but yeah. Consider what the author does with it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Thank you for that reminder. The other warning sections in Hebrews, and indeed the whole background of the book, Ben.
And that ties in what you just said, Alan, I think, with the uses of the word better here, right? What's better? You know, what do you think is better than what God's planning and preparing? You know, that's going to just blow up in your face.
Right. Just real quick on that, again, to piggyback on what Ben says. Does throwing a brick through another man's business window give you a clear conscience? What else gives you a clear conscience? There's only one thing that gives you a clear conscience, and that is the sacrifice that Christ did of himself for you.
Right. What about then gospel promises? Those seem to be very evident in this text as well. But how would you go about preaching the gospel based off of this text, or maybe referring? A number of you have referred to Luke 6 and that section. What do you think? Gospel, how would you articulate it based on Hebrews 11, 32 to 40? John, some thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the old saying, cheer up, it's the cross, comes to mind, but why is that good news? Certainly, we can talk about gospel, about where we're going to be, but then the gospel is also who we are right now. This is All Saints. We are saints right now, and we referenced Joel Osteen before, and obviously he gives some ridiculous answers at times to our status, but he is hitting on something that people are yearning to know. Where is their worth? Where is my status? How can I feel good about myself? We have the right answers here in Hebrews chapter 11. It's all through what God has done for me. He's the one who's making me perfect with all the saints on earth. And when I've preached this or Hebrews 12 too, sometimes I've gone back, I've highlighted some of those stories in my law section of the sermon, you know, people like David who slew a giant, and the prophets Isaiah probably who was sawed in half. And you just say, is that you? Is that me? And no. But then who are those people though too? You know, David who broke all 10 commandments in one chapter of the Bible. Some of these other ones that are mentioned here, we'd look at their stories and they didn't always look like shining saints either. You have someone who sacrificed his daughter, if you look through that list, and things like that, because of a foolish vow he made. So even though this is like the Hall of Fame of saints here, the heroes of faith, boy, they really screwed up, didn't they? And yet they are saints, and God used it all and delivered them through it. And so absolutely, Lord, I should not be commended for my faith. We mentioned that before, but by your grace and mercy, I am a saint no less than David, or than anyone on this list. What a wonderful status that I have.
Yeah. Yeah. Further thoughts on the gospel, Ben?
Well, I mean, if you just keep talking about that, those two phrases, the world was not worthy of them, and all of them were commended or spoken well of. Yeah, what you just said, John, that this list is people who are overwhelmed. Some were crazy or considered crazy, but God says they're the best. You know, John, what does Jesus say about John? No one greater among women has ever been born than this kind of wacky hermit out in the desert who eats bugs and calls out all the authorities. No one better. And that's only grace that God would declare that despite what we are, that's the small called articles. I always go back to that phrase, though I have this sinful nature hanging around my neck, God would not count it against me. Because these guys knew something. They were looking for a better resurrection. They knew that's why they refused to be released, because that's like a resurrection. You get out of jail. I said, no, I will continue to suffer because there's something better. That was Paul's agony. I want to serve you, but I want to be with Jesus. I want to get out of this earthly tent and be in the spiritual tent. So yeah, just building on that.
Thank you. Bringing that home to people, What takeaways do you leave your listeners with this week? I think we've just mentioned some, just the status that we have as saints, in spite of everything, our own weakness and sin, the pressure the world puts on us. I mean, that's a beautiful truth for appropriation. We are saints in spite of everything. Other things, are the thoughts for application or further thoughts to grab onto and hold on to,
Yeah.
Ben?
When Alan was working through kind of our speed exegesis, and I was trying to keep up with all of the stuff, and that last verse, verse 40, was kind of a tricksy one as I was working on it, because it says in English, or at least in the NIV, he has planned something better for us that only together with us, which is the positive way of stating it, but the writer kind of said it in a, using negative language, hinam me chloris hemon, so that not apart from us. And I know that maybe it's awkward in English, so why they changed it, but you think about this whole thing is about God's plans, right? That God has planned something better. And we're getting a glimpse into God's eternal workings on All Saints Day. He's planning, he's putting things into place, in the words of Dune, plans within plans within plans, right? And this section with all these people kind of fights our tendency to we want to think individually. There's a lot of forest and trees stuff going on here. We'll lose the forest for the trees if I'm getting sawed in half, that God has abandoned me or something. But God's thinking of the church and the whole church and nothing but the church. And so I got to thinking about 1 Thessalonians 4, where God promises no one left behind, like a good general, not the dead, not the living, not the abused, not the murdered, not the tortured, not the traumatized, not those suffering PTSD, not the ones who've been hurt by the church, not the ones who are hurting the church. In faith in Christ, no one is left behind. And while Mick Jagger said we don't get any satisfaction, God says you will be satisfied finally in the end. And that's I to me that's what this what used to be called the end time season is about. There will finally be satisfaction in the end for us.
Yeah, satisfaction, vindication, right? It will be there, even though we do not see it now. It will come through for us. Bringing things together, any ideas for themes, or kind of unifying statements as preachers begin to think in those terms, putting all their thoughts together? John, any possibilities that you've got?
Yeah, just kind of rough themes going through my mind. I mean, looks can be deceiving, right? You could probably play on that for a little bit. It's this back and forth between who looks to be victorious and who actually is. God's better way. I wrote down God's reality show because I liked Alan said earlier, recasting of reality. You could play on that theme a little bit too. What's real or God's perfect plans. Ben just mentioned that too, that God has plans for what is coming. And in the end, this can all be inspirational too. We're going through some tough things here, but it's inspirational at the same time. I did a lot of ministry outside of Washington, D.C., went to a lot of war memorials and things like that. And you'd read of these battles and this carnage and all of that. And it was hard and it was tough. But in the end, you said, wow, what an amazing thing they did. It wasn't something to be ashamed of that they went off and died for this great cause. It was a wonderful thing that still impacts us today. And maybe that's another little gospel thought there. But so often we think, what's the point? What's the purpose? It all seems meaningless. I'm sure Isaiah thought that and Jeremiah and the prophets many days too. But finally, in the end, nothing will be in vain. Forever in eternity, what God did through me by his strength and power will be celebrated. We will be a hero of faith too. And in the long run, we'll look back and we won't exchange any of those crosses, any of those trials, because we'll say that was just right. And he even used my weaknesses for his glory. So I don't know, a few thoughts there.
Yeah, thank you. Alan?
Yeah, I read recently that young people are leaving the American Evangelical Church or leaving core beliefs, millennialistically speaking, For example, the mass conversion of the Jews, they're rejecting that because influenced by mass media, influenced by pro-Palestinian rhetoric, they're just like losing interest in that core teaching. And young people are leaving let's say the politically minded, where you have an American evangelical political action committee that young people are finding that offensive. But it's not just hardly American evangelical losing young people. I think we can see in our own church body that it's hard to hang on to young people. And I wonder sometimes if part of our problem with hanging on to young people is we perhaps prefer to keep them in a bubble or in the hot bath of Bible stories, just trying to get them to relax from all of their distresses instead of putting a sword and a shield into their hands and saying, what we have here, again, to use the phrase, a workshop on your mission in life, and to really get aggressive about what the author is aggressive about, that in our witnessing to the world, the best witness we can give is to be fearless in the face of being a Christian in the world and not being deceived by the world. And I just think there's a lot here to say to not just young people, but everybody. But I think focusing on young people, here is how you get involved in your culture that is really drifting away from God. I read recently that the United Kingdom, or perhaps England in particular, no longer considers itself a Christian nation because there's not enough Christians in that nation to call it a Christian nation. Where is this all headed? What is our response? And I think this text like it really give us an answer to what our next step is.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, challenging us, but equipping us even as through those challenges, right? Yeah, further thoughts? I don't know, Ben, if you have any suggestions for preachers kind of bringing things together.
Yeah, I have one that is as always kind of trite and one that's not yet fully formed. I can't help when we hear the word better all the time here. I think my favorite Bond song, "Nobody Does It Better Than God." Just that's the theme in of Hebrews, right? Jesus is better than everything. So that's a little bit trite, but that just pops into my head. But Alan, when you were going to again through your speed exegesis, you talked about used the word solidarity. And I've been thinking about that word the whole time. And this one is not fully formed, and it's got a lot of S alliteration, probably too much. But I was thinking of something like, our Lord shows us a church of stunning solidarity, that we are all together in shame and suffering, and we are all together in salvation. That, like you said, there's a lot of S's in there. So that's kind of what that word keyed off to me, something when Alan said it.
Sounds like a workshop to me, Benjamin.
Yeah, maybe.
No, great ideas. I think there's a lot for preachers to work with there. Any concluding thoughts or anything we haven't had a chance to mention yet, or another thought that's been sparked?
Yeah, I mean, it obviously this text goes on, and Hebrews 12 kind of is almost the application there. Therefore, let's run this great race. And I get that's not in our reading for today, but that's great, a great encouragement too, that things are going to get better. Absolutely. And if I know that something is better is coming, I tend to be more motivated to work. If I know that I get to go fishing for a week in Canada for muskies with my brother, it's amazing how much I work the week before and how much better my attitude is. How awesome. My problems are going to come to the end. I'm going to be in eternity forever. No more mourning or crying or weeping or pain, blessed forever with treasures in heaven. Hey, I got nothing to lose. Better is coming. And so that means that the bad that I feel now isn't going to destroy me either. Bad can be good. It reminds me of what Alan said a little bit ago. Our generation or our times now maybe are so obsessed with trying to feel good. We're almost anxious about being anxious or things like that. And it's okay. We're going to have these ups and downs. Let's get real, right? But when we're in those down times, God still has me. I'm still a saint. And yeah, I have a real better that's coming. I am going to live forever with the other saints too.
Yeah, Ben.
Two things you guys both just said. You talked about getting real, and Alan, you talked about the need to connect with young people, which is one of the three groups that are four groups, I suppose we could say they're ignored, right? Babies, the young, single people, and the elderly, right? Always ignored in the church. And you could get this text and end up with that, because this comes right after Reformation, one of the most earth-shattering events in history. And we're talking about guys, I mean, other than Jesus, Martin Luther's like the most written about guy in the world. And then this list of people, these are monsters, right? These are the mega heroes of the church, and none of us are going to be like that. So to hear about faith, and then we think about a lot of earth-shattering things faith does, but there are the little things too, like the death of the saints that God says he loves, the conversion of just one sinner that Jesus says creates a party in heaven, baptizing a child, which our pastors get to do, none of whom, most of us will never be in a list like this. Feeding our congregation with the supper. These heroes of faith aren't just Old Testament guys or New Testament guys who get a festival in the church. And they aren't just men, they aren't just women, they aren't just black, they aren't just white. They're all types of men and women of faith. And I think the author is getting us to that too, that this is you guys. God had planned something better for us. That's tying it to the congregation for us.
That's a great thought, Ben.
Yeah.
This is us too, and we have pastors listening in, so it's us, you know. And this last week on my day off, I got a phone call from a longtime member, supposed to be my day off, and he disagrees with a doctrinal point. He wants to leave the church, and so I tried to express as winsomely as possible the truth of the gospel. And at the end, he wants to leave the church. I'm trying to get a hold of another member who's currently ripping apart his family, arguing with his siblings, and causing all kinds of trouble. I don't know whether he's going to listen to me or not. Some of these things that I go through in any week, I did not dream of when I was sitting on a sunny hill at the seminary. And at the end of many of these days, I don't really feel triumphant, but I am. Every night I go to sleep, and God says, John, you're a saint. You're a saint, and in me, you're perfect. This includes me, and this includes the people listening. This includes you. I like how you said that. Everyone in our church.
Thank you. Yeah, may that status of saint give us the stamina that we need. And preachers, may you be renewed in your stamina for service as you wrestle with this text and get ready to proclaim it to your people. And may all who hear you and these beautiful words from Hebrews 11 be rejuvenated and may their stamina be built up to live as saints of God in this world. Thank you all for participating today. Preachers, the Lord bless your message.